And if you have any questions to put to me, this is a good opportunity. We'll have another opportunity later. Yes, sir.
And people from Cambridge, I think, are institutions in a pretty healthy state. But obviously, they can, from time to time, run into trouble. And you could get situations where one group of board members are running things in a certain way, perhaps other board members are very concerned about that. I think perhaps it's not good. All those kind of things.
Sure. Yes, in a way, I don't want to go too far into this because it's a little bit of a... It arises in the course of the discussion rather than being the central issue. But I appreciate the question. To be relatively brief about it, I think you could say it's yes and no. In other words, I don't think we need new institutions, but I think that activating those institutions much more fully almost amounts to new institutions, if you see what I mean. So that, for instance, we do have a presidential system, which is meant to be a check and a balance. And that presidential system is tied into the college, which is tied into the overall structure of the area council and so forth and so on. All of these need to be much more active, much more active. And so I think often where there are real difficulties in centres, it's dealt with in a very roundabout and arm's length way. Sometimes that's skillful, that's a good way to deal with it. But often I think it does need much more direct and active intervention. The other issue that we have been reflecting on, and especially came up in India, is really quite extreme unskillful behaviour by order members. You know, beyond the point at which one can simply say it's the normal unskillfulness that we all indulge in. And we have the institutions to deal with that, but they've not really been activated. So by and large, I think that we don't need new... Well, probably we don't need new committees or agencies or whatever. By and large, we just need to use what we've got more fully. And in the course of using what we've got more fully, it may be that we need to do something more formalised, as it were. But in the first instance, my own view is that we need to activate what we've got. I think we've really only very recently come to a clear overall organisational structure independent of Bante. Bante was the organisational structure. He was the court of last appeal. He was the final arbiter, as it were. Of course, for quite a long time, he's not been able to be involved in everything. But implicitly, he's been the last stop. But yes, in the last 3 or 4 years, we've been activating this new system of the councils. They're much more effective in Britain than anywhere else in the world, at least on the movement side. On the order side, it's still not sufficiently articulated, in my belief. In India, it's much more articulated. So I think we've still got quite a bit to do to use the institutions that we've got more fully. There will always be problems, human beings being what they are, and it will never be possible to, you know, always handle everything as it should be. But I think then there needs to be a much more active introspection after events, if you see what I mean. Not a beating up, but... A kind of thing. Well, Why did that take so long to get dealt with? What happened here? What were the issues that just got sort of missed and went on for quite a long time? And so on. You don't want to be dealing with things only when, the house is on fire. You want to be turning the gas off a bit earlier than that, if you can. If you can. So, yes, I think we part of what we need to be doing in order to honour the lineage of institutions is use them much more thoroughly. While I was speaking, actually, it occurred to me that that's probably true of all the lineages. We've got them, but we need to use them more thoroughly. And from that, I think, will come a natural evolution, if you see what I mean. So does that at least go some way to...
Yes, I think it does. I mean, not all centres even really have an active president.
Indeed, yeah. Well, there are centres without an active chair. And so that means they don't have a link into the chairs meeting, which is a very important institution. And so on. There are some centres without active mitra conveners. And that affects things. So that there needs to be... what Bante's extraordinary for, sometimes infuriatingly extraordinary, is vigilance. He spots everything. And the other day when I saw him, he was... not the other day, but when I saw him before he got ill, he was saying, who is going to be looking out for wrong views? Who is going to be looking out for, just divergence and decay? He's so sharp and so sensitive. We need to take that on collectively. So I think it's part of really accepting the lineage that we've been given is activating these institutions much more fully and thereby evolving them further. I think there's a tendency... I don't know whether it's general in human nature or something of that kind, but I think there's a tendency, you feel something's missing, so you invent something new. And so this goes on in the field of practice. You feel that something's missing, so you go looking for something new. Whereas often what's needed is looking more deeply into what you've actually got and drawing more out of it. Because, undoubtedly that shows, can show that there's a lacuna, as they say in India. But you need to look first down into what you've got and see whether you can draw more out of it, whether it's with teachings, practices, or institutions. Inspiration's slightly different category, but... So useful reflection. Priyananda. Right.
What is the mechanism for those teachings evolving as we go into not just the next few years, but the next decades and so on?
Indeed.
And so it arose partly out of thinking about, at least in some areas, there's a question about some teachings. So people are not necessarily dismissing them, but just a question of them, and they dismiss them. But an example of one is the teaching on the new society. It's almost like, some people might say that's not central, that's a sort of peripheral picture. They may make that judgment. So what would be the advice of evolution to decide on core teaching?
Yes. A very important and necessary question. It's not a simple answer that can be given, because one can't simply have a board of teachings that decides what are valid teachings and what are not. However, there does need to be some sort of process for dialogue and discussion amongst senior order members holding important responsibilities about what they're willing to sort of endorse. So a discussion has been taking place, which needs to involve a lot more people. In fact, just 2 weeks ago, I had a meeting at my place in Wales of people who are concerned about teaching at Mysquin. At Adisthana. And what Bhante hopes is that Adisthana will be a sort of... a place where his teachings are really safeguarded and people are trained in them, and where we can test and clarify those and extend them where necessary. So what I think is that we will find developing there is a pool of people, hopefully, 50, 60, 100, who are quite senior, experienced order members, who are in active dialogue with each other and have themselves important connections with the principal institutions. And things can be thrashed out. So we're talking about, for instance, questions have been raised about approaches to the teaching and practice of, let's call it insight, spiritual death. Rather topically, are the ways in which that could be done that we don't do at the moment? What exactly are we doing and so forth? So we're going to put together a series of discussions amongst a number of people who are interested in this field from a range of different competences. So people who are sort of teaching meditation specifically, people who are in centres teaching meditation, because that's one thing that happens. People who are teaching meditation in the specialist area do one thing and people in the centres do another, and then you get a weird sort of conflict. So important that everybody comes together with some scholars who are able to say, no, come on, this is just mythology. And then we can get down to write what is the authentic basis for it all. So we hope to start at Adisthana. We've been doing it a little bit already. A semi-formal process of discussion, which involves people like you and people from the centre here who could be part of that, which could then be fed into the chairman's meeting, the chair's meeting, all kind of endorsed by the college. Do you see what I mean? So that it's a thoroughly British sort of muddle. But I hope it'll work. I don't think it would work if we had a censorship body, as it were, that was responsible for kind of deciding what was okay and what was not. Partly because teaching's not like that, and partly because it's an absolutely thankless job, and partly because I'm pretty sure people would think that I should be on it, as well as people thinking I shouldn't be on it. And my goodness, I don't want either of those. Do you see what I mean? It would be an awful job, an awful job. So I think it has to be a broad process that's kind of bit messy, a bit loose, but where in the end it's possible for a centre to say, well, I'm sorry, we don't really feel that's an appropriate way to teach. If you want to teach like that, you can't do that here. Until we've got more clarity about where it fits in, and we've heard from others who are more experienced and more more knowledgeable. Do you see what I mean? I think there does have to be a point at which it's possible to say no. But at the same time, I don't think it should be a sharp and fast line. It's going to be a bit fuzzy always. But we all have to be a little bit vigilant. And be prepared to say, no, look, I kind of hear what you're saying, but how does that fit? Who have you talked to about that? So what tends to happen, and this is because of the times we've come from, you're teaching, then you go and read a book, and the next class you do, you teach what you've just read before you've really even absorbed it. It's literally, this is what can happen. Or you get a bit of personal inspiration and then you just bring that in. And it starts to look like an adult education class or a sort of, a clearinghouse for a multitude of Buddhist teachings. And, well, I don't think that promotes spiritual community. Because what you end up with is too many different approaches which don't really easily integrate. So I think it's everybody needs to have a sensitivity to this sense of the lineage of teachings. And it's not that we cannot explore and evolve. We must, otherwise we die. For instance, you mentioned the new society. I think that it's clear that people just don't get fired up by that idea much, or at least by the heading of it. So it has to be come at from a slightly different point of view. It's central to Bhante's approach that there is the creation of conditions in which practice is strongly supported, and in which there's a strong overlap between people. That's central to his way of teaching. I don't think you can dispense with that. If you dispense with that, you're basically saying it's, Sangharakshita without Sangharakshita, if you like. But you don't have to call it the new society. So there needs to be a discussion. And Adhisthana will be, in the first place, a locus for that kind of discussion, where we can come to a better mutual understanding and approach. It's never going to be completely tidy. Do you see what I mean? I have to say that part of my purpose in my last paper was to give a new theoretical or doctrinal, let's say, approach to that very question. I hardly mentioned the title, the word New Society, but I wanted to show how that relates to Bhante's whole teaching, in dialogue with him. So do you see what I mean? I think there's a complex process of discussion. The first point is that every order member, and no doubt if you've asked for ordination, which I'm told you all have, everybody's asked for ordination, needs to recognise is central to their commitment an acceptance of this lineage and a working within that lineage, which is not, Bhante didn't teach it, therefore I mustn't do it. Or Bhante did teach it, therefore I must. It's more what this is the integrated system. And how does, my experience fit into that? And how can that be unfolded further? So in dialogue with your own teachers, your own Kalyanamitras, if it's a large enough issue that needs to be taken up more centrally, to put it that way, ultimately, the public preceptors need to be the guardians of that, the integrity of all that. But they can't do it alone. Being the sort of person that people will naturally assume should be somewhere in the middle of it, or is in the middle of it and shouldn't be, I really don't think that's a good idea. If you see what I mean, it's a thankless and impossible task. So we need to activate the our responsibility as order members and as those intending to join the order, and see that we've inherited something, value it highly, and if you feel as sort of you've reached some kind of limit or you found something that's slightly outside it, then go to a lot of trouble to explore how that relates, if you see what I mean. First of all, have you actually missed something in what we've got? And secondly, if you feel, well, no, there is something legitimate here that does need bringing in, well, then you need a dialogue with which is a restrained dialogue, a disciplined dialogue. What the usual dialogue is, you just get up and you start teaching it. Honestly, this is what happens. And that just breeds tensions and misunderstandings, and people get very frustrated, even if it's good, because it just doesn't sort of fit. So we all need to take that responsibility, that we have a responsibility to the lineage we've inherited, which doesn't mean a static responsibility, but the working with it must be a strong process of dialogue. Yeah, this is a bit topical, but I think it's Nobody need feel that they're deprived of anything, if you see what I mean, as long as they engage in the right sort of dialogue. As again, part of Bhante's genius is that he always founds practice on principle. So we can always go back to the principle and from there lead to integration. But what Bhante says in that paper, What is the Order, is that the order cannot remain united unless there is a high degree of commonality of practice. And one might add in teaching as well. A high degree of commonality. Everybody in this room has done the mindfulness of breathing. At least a few times. Everybody's done the metta bhavana. Everybody's just sat. Everybody's heard the Eightfold Path. You know what I mean? We've got a vocabulary of practice and experience that is strongly in common with us. I'm not even thinking about it. I'm just assuming that you know what I'm talking about in the basic vocabulary. Well, if you're coming from a completely different sort of practice perspective, I'd have to speak in a different way, which would mean I couldn't speak as deeply in certain respects. In some ways I could, but the fact that we all share a high degree of commonality of practice and teaching with our own individual variations and so forth and so on, makes us united. But it's a lot of work involved by us as individuals if that's to remain. And I do think that we've got a bit of tidying up to do in our order. And in the movement. I think there's a bit of people need to appreciate this principle and decide really whether they're willing to do the work. If you're not willing to do the work, I get into trouble when I say this sort of thing, you know, get out. You know what, if you want to remain part of it, you've got to do the work. It's not fair. Last time I said that in an order context, everybody hated me. You all love me, don't you? But it's true, isn't it? It's true. It means something being in this order. Otherwise, why the hell have you asked to join it? It sort of means not that. It means this, not that. It's a choice. So, you know, if you don't want what's implied by that choice, well, don't come or get out. Because it just makes it awkward for everybody else. That's never going to be entirely tidy, and we're always going to find a way of picking a problem with somebody on ideological grounds, which is actually nothing to do with ideology. It's just to do with the fact we don't like the shape of their face. But nonetheless, the sort of basic principle is that it's work. Being part of a sangha is work. Joyful work, of course, a lot of the time, but it's work. You have to work to overcome the barriers, the differences, the difficulties, the confusions. And it's our practice. That work is our practice, if you see what I mean. Oh, you got me stirred up now, so calm down.
Some of what you said is quite strong, and it counteracted what he said prior to it. So I'm wondering, it's a bit about language of connecting. You used the word discipline at one stage, and I think discipline connection might work. We can't just, if we have a worry, you know, it might be like me, it takes a while to wind around it and talk about it before I put my things together and get an answer that is insightful for me, and I'll use it. So we need to stay in the order at least for a good while and connect with what it is that's agitating us. That's difficult, you know, and this seems Cambridge. I mean, I'm sort of talking about Cambridge. There are some... We need to connect with...
Isn't this just what I've said?
Yes.
Yeah, I said that you've got to work. And if you don't want to do the work, then don't do it. Don't stay. Yeah.
I'm worried about the emphasis that came after that. Because I've seen people with something that's worth staying in for and listening to and understanding them more.
I'm a little puzzled because I thought this was just what I've said. That if you're willing to do the work, stay. If you're not willing to do the work, then don't.
Yeah, right, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. I'll just leave it.
Yeah, you're disquiet somewhere.
Well, I think the words for me that are important is this staying and connect or consult about it. And if it continues on, well...
Yeah. Well, if you are willing to connect, and what was the other word? Well, then you, that's the work that I'm talking about. But if you're not,
okay, so yeah, I'm yeah. About the way you used the word work in the last instance. Sorry, Sir.
Yeah.
That's the same.
Yeah. No, it's okay.
It's very strong.
Yeah.
I know people that yeah. would react.
Yeah. I think it's good that people react. I think there has to be a bit of a whoops. What's this? Mm-hmm. There's something. I don't think we're really putting enough work into this. I think there needs to be quite a sort of, wait a minute, it's not nothing being in this order. Yeah.
But connection is a funny word, is it not?
I'm sorry?
Connection is a funny word or a funny meaning because connection is there and that's the nature of us all, that we are connected. At the same time, it takes tremendous effort to actually peel off the layers of what we call the four views, in order to get to that understanding, to make it conscious, I suppose, to make it fruitful. It's very interesting that you use the word blessing, because it is not something that is very strongly featuring in the Tree Ratna practices, I feel, because I suppose... Maybe it's just how I sort of like understand it, or how I sort of take practices on board. It's perhaps more pragmatic or more practical, whereas blessing is clearly quite a mythical.
Oh, yes, this is the fourth lineage.
Yes.
In lineage of inspiration, yeah.
Yes. So it is a connected with inspiration. I'm not quite sure about the difference between blessing and inspiration.
Well, I suppose, as it were, etymologically, inspiration implies something sort of coming from within. But not necessarily, of course. You can be inspired by the muse. So, no, in tradition it comes from outside, doesn't it?
By another person.
Or by another person, yeah. They're somewhat different takes on the same phenomenon, I'd say. Yeah. Blessing sort of implies something somewhat more passive, but then in a way, so does inspiration in a certain or receptive. Yeah, but no, I would say they're fundamentally the same experience.
So I suppose if blessings don't work, if it doesn't lead to me passing blessings on, then inspirations wouldn't work.
Well, I think that's true, isn't it? If inspiration is not enacted, if it's not passed on, it dies. Better to strangle a babe at birth than to nurse unacted desires. Is it Blake? Sorry, don't. I probably provoked enough today. unacted desires, he means inspiration, creative inspiration. And what he's saying is, if you don't act upon that creative inspiration, it dies. It worse than dies, it goes poisonous.
But this is very much about Kalyana.
It's very much about Kalyana Mitrata. Kalyana Mitrata is it's concerned with all four lineages, but it's particularly, I think, most characteristically about the fourth lineage, the lineage of inspiration. Because the fourth lineage can't be summed up in words. It can't be summed up in a practice, although it also is contained in those. It can't be institutionalized, although an institution can support it. And in the end, it has to be a living interaction between people, or between a person and an image or a vision. The Tibetans say, don't they, that there are four kinds of blessing, or three kinds of blessing, that comes from I can't remember how to put it now, but anyway, it comes fundamentally from an individual, from a person, from a teacher, or it comes from an image, or a painting or something of that kind. And I presume that from that one could also say even a teaching. Or it comes from a vision.
So you had a conversation with Anjali during the break, and I just sort of like talked with her about what happened before the break, because she arrived from the break.
Yeah.
And she said, well, friendship is, works like that as well. Like
but
you can't have friendship.
You can't?
You can't have a friendship. Mm-hmm. It's it. You own a friend.
Huh.
And, I think friendships can get the line if you then become a friend.
Yes. Yeah. 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 Well, that's Bhante's aphorism, isn't it? If you want to have a friend, be a friend.
Yeah.
It's something that has to be active.
But it also.
Maybe we should, because there are so many people, it can't get too conversational, if you'll excuse me, because then it sort of, others lose connection. So it has to be focused on me, to my delight, but I apologise. Mm. So anything else before we go any further? Mm. Ivan, bully.
Fired up on the last papers and so on, talking about, but you even mentioned committing, going for refuge effectively at some point, or even acting as a member of the order, is being actively committed yourself to the spiritual death and spiritual rebirth.
Hmm.
And a lot of my, what's the sense of putting yourself to one side to, you were talking on the first half, but to just responsiveness, to your act with your karma and your character, to something else to arise. And that seemed to be linked also with inspiration. So I guess, I guess my feeling is just that I don't have very clear how we. Can how we do more effectively this spiritual death and spiritual rebirth.
Huh.
It's kind of quite clear that on the ordination conference you have the five much practice, so there is other practices, but we don't each we hardly talk about them in instruction courses or in our life. And I guess as well you could maybe we could have a bit more experience with spiritual death and rebirth through practicing friendship and
religion.
Or anyway, I have
so rather a bundle there. I'm not quite sure which part of the bundle to pick up. So you mentioned spiritual death and spiritual rebirth. So let me rewind a bit and try to connect those up to the theme that I'm wanting to sort of pursue and see whether this gives you any satisfaction at all or provokes more bundles. So the metaphor of inspiration and the metaphor of blessing all implies something from beyond you. That's the purpose and point of the metaphors, isn't it? That they point to something that touches you or arises within you or enters into you that is not you. And clearly what this points to is this stream of non-egoic conditioned processes that arises particularly after stream entry, when you die spiritually. So when you yourself get out of the way, this stream of inspired energy flows through you. Or in the language of the early Prajnaparamita, these blessings flow into you. So your experience is that something is happening which is not to do with your will, so that you feel yourself to be functioning on the basis of motivating forces that are not, in the ordinary sense, yours. You know, I lift my hand. I think of myself as actually making my hand raise. It's not quite that simple when you start to analyse it. But that's the way it sort of presents itself. I came to this event. I said this. But there are states that arise even before stream entry where you feel that's not the case, that something seems to be happening through you. The most characteristic mode of that is poetic or artistic or aesthetic inspiration, where the artist, the skilled artist, deliberately suspends will and allows their skills to be at the service of something that comes from deeper. Talking to a Bhayavadra at the LBC, who is a very fine painter, is at Vajrasana. And he was showing me some of his paintings, which are big, big canvases, and quite, because it's big, so there's a big statement, if you see what I mean. Once you've drawn a line, it affects the whole canvas very strongly. And he said that he doesn't really know what he's going to do until he starts. He clearly was not just kind of doing the rhetoric of art, the artist. He said that things seem to just come out of the canvas. So that probably not at the level of Dhamma Niyama processes in the fullest sense, but perhaps something of Dhamma Niyama processes are involved there. These suprapersonal energies. Suprapersonal is quite straightforward. Some people have said that this is, rather sort of, what's the word for it? Rarefied terminology. But all it's saying is not personal, beyond the person. It's not subpersonal, it's beyond the person. So there's a sense of something that's not really me or mine. And I, as I quoted in that paper, the last paper, Bhante's experience in Nagpur in 1956, which really, really strongly affected me reading that. Because I know the situation, I know the people who were there. And, Bhante finding himself, what he describes himself as, I felt myself to be not a person, but an impersonal force. And he acted without premeditation. He was speaking without having any thoughts in his mind at all. And yet what he was saying was exactly what people needed to hear. What level that's on, I'm not interested in. But it was clearly an experience of something way beyond him. As it were, working through him, as it were. And again, I quoted a letter he wrote to me saying that when he looked back on the order of what we've got in the movement today, he finds it quite incredible that he could have started it or founded it, and he realises he didn't. The way he puts it was as if it was founded through me. So what he's talking about is states that arise within you that don't refer to anybody else, but they don't refer to you. You don't feel they're my thoughts. You feel that they simply arise within you, and at the same time you fully assent to them. You know, your will is fully aligned with them. It's not that there's a struggle and some demonic force is possessing you, which you're trying to fight away. It's that you're opening yourself up to, or you willingly open yourself up to a kind of mood or attitude or atmosphere or thought or inspiration or blessing that arises within you. So that finds its fullest expression when you enter the stream of the Dhamma, when you decisively break through self-clinging. At stream entry, the position we're in is that, to a greater or lesser extent, we're not at that level. And there's still, to a greater or lesser extent, quite a bit of I in the way, and our struggle is to get to the point where we can allow that blessing And it's a good way of speaking to talk of it as a blessing. The suprapersonal force as a blessing. That's the way you experience it. You try to get yourself out of the way as much as you can so that that can function through you. How do you do that? First of all, you integrate yourself. Then you develop skillful action, skillful karma, positive emotion. You learn to be receptive to those sort of forces moving within you. You practice spiritual receptivity. You do just sitting practice with that open, kind of inviting attitude. You try to engage in a sympathetic way in friendship. You try to open yourself up to others. You try to open yourself to teachers. Try to open yourself up to art, culture, to the Dhamma. So you deliberately cultivate an open, receptive mood. But then you need to tackle what gets in the way, which is the structure of self-clinging. It's quite a big topic, which I might come on to in a minute. But you tackle the structure of self-clinging through reflection on the constructed nature of that self-clinging, that it refers to no genuine reality, no authentic reality. And I think that in some ways, and this is a general conclusion which Bhante's supported, that probably people need to be doing this earlier than ordination. They need to be doing this sort of reflection, this sort of consideration, this sort of self-examination from fairly early on. But it needs to be appropriate, you know, at the right level. If you approach things too much in that way too early on, either people that they're too unintegrated, so it just becomes a head thing. I think it's a big danger with a lot of that Vipassana stuff. Of course, it's absolutely true Buddhism, as it were. But when it's done in the wrong context, as a lot of people take it up they think themselves into mindfulness or into insight. It's not insight at all. It's just a clear conceptual understanding. Or they get freaked out, and this is not uncommon. People get freaked out or depressed or something like that. Or it can end up confirming fundamental nihilism, which basically, if you're from at least from the Protestant countries of the Western world, if not ex-Catholics, we are inherently nihilistic. So we need to find a way of reflecting on the inadequacy of the self that's appropriate to us and at our level. If you've asked for ordination, I think you've asked to... you've said that you want to die spiritually. So if you're serious about that, then you really need to be starting to engage with that. I'd suggest at the very least taking up reflection on the so-called five ordinary reflections, the Buddha's five ordinary reflections, or the four mind turnings, five ordinary reflections. I'm subject to aging. I will get old. I'm subject to illness. I will get sick. I'm subject to dying. I will die. I'm subject to death. I will die. Whatever is dear and loved by me, from that I must be parted. And then finally, that I am the owner of my karma, the heir to my karma. Karma is my birth, from the womb from which I've sprung, is my parents. Karma is my protection. Whatever actions I perform, whether skillful or unskillful, of those I will become heir. So something like those kinds of reflections, or maybe even reflections on the Lakshanas, I think you need to be doing, so that you're increasingly challenging the underlying structure. I'm sure that any effective practice of mindfulness will take you into that area. The Satipatthana Sutta applies those sort of reflections to the direct experience of the four Satipatthana. So you need to take that into your practice. It needs to be part of your regular practice in a way that's appropriate for you. And you need to be engaging with your Kalyana Mitras and teachers to find a way that, for you, takes you into a challenge to your self-clinging. Friendship does that to some extent. But, it needs to be more than just, you know, a meeting for a cup of tea. It needs to be a meeting that comes up against the boundaries of your self-clinging. I don't mean that just nasty, but that where people ask you questions and you ask each other questions and you particularly come into contact with people who see things differently than you. You come into deep contact with them and you go beyond the difficulties and the problems that arise. So I think that we need to be working much more actively to get out of the way. Then these blessings can flow.
Absolutely.
Mm.
A Christian would say that the result of every symptom is God's design.
Mm.
Where is it coming from?
Mm. Yeah. Well, in a way, you can see that as a metaphor. Unfortunately, a lot of dogma, institution, and history is piled on top of all that. But as a simple metaphor, I kind of don't have a problem with it these days. I can sort of talk about God's blessings. Don't worry, it's all right. Don't panic. Do you know what I mean? As a distant metaphor. Where does it come from? Well, of course, in Buddhism, we say we don't. There's no answer possible in principle to that, because in Kant's phrasing, it's a question that's too big for our brains. If you see what I mean, we're trying to stand outside the whole structure of our consciousness to ask a question about something within it. It can't be done, if you see what I mean. Or it leads simply to naivety and a simplistic literalism. So what we say is these blessings arise in dependence on conditions. So I can tell you what the conditions are in dependence upon which they arise, and that's all I need to do. When the conditions are there, the blessings arise. When your heart is open and you have got out of the way, and something emerges that evokes those blessings, blessings will arise. If you go to the teacher, you go to see Bhante, and you're fed up with him, and you've decided he's not really a teacher, and you're determined to get everything sorted out and so forth, you probably won't get any experience of blessings, although you might. Do you see what I mean? When the conditions are not right, but when you enter into a conversation with your Kalyana Mitra, where you're genuinely concerned for the Dharma, you're genuinely reaching for the Dharma, you've got quite a degree of openness, quite a degree of emotional positivity, the blessings may arise, to put it that way. So this is the power of the Dhamma, isn't it? That we don't need to refer to metaphysical entities that stand outside the experiencing situation. We simply need to refer to the general process and the particularities of it in action. So yeah, I don't have a quarrel with Christian experience, necessarily. If a Christian tells me that he's experiencing the blessings of God, I'm quite happy to say that he's experiencing blessings, and that for him those are phrased in terms of God. I would say to him, I find that language problematic, and it gives too easily gives too easily way to misunderstanding and reification and limitation. But the experience of inspiration, of blessing even, is not a Buddhist one. It's a human one, and it arises, I think, within many contexts. But what Buddhism does is give a very clear understanding of what it is, and therefore makes it very easy to accommodate that experience and also to to set up the conditions for it arising. Yeah, I had a very interesting experience in a talk I gave at the LBC. There was a convinced Christian who, don't very seldom experience this, who was sort of, every now and again, would interpose, well, this is simply the blessings of God and all the rest of it. And in the end, I said to him, look, I'm not quarrelling. We share, I think, possibly, we share a common experience. I put a different framework on that, which I think avoids a lot of problems. But yes, I felt I had some affinity with him. So this experience of blessing, this experience of inspiration, this experience of suprapersonal forces, it's part of life. It's a potentiality within life. The Dhamma is life, if you see what I mean. And what it does is what the Buddha's teaching does, is make very clear how life works. It works, it is a vast, complex process of dependently arising of things that arise in dependence on conditions, you know what I'm saying, and that there are different kinds of conditionality. The blessings arise within the context of Dhamma Niyama, if you see what I mean. They arise, of course, in what in Buddhism would be referred to as godlike states, the upper reaches of the Karma Niyama. The Karma Niyama. When you really open up yourself through karmic work, then you feel as if you're in contact with higher forces and energies, which are not necessarily dharmic. Yes, exactly. In the prostration practice, at the end of that practice, you are deliberately, you're practicing spiritual receptivity. You're opening yourself to the purifying influence of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. And it's very tangible, isn't it? If you really do put the work in, if you do fling yourself down with sufficient conviction, When you open yourself up, you experience something happening. Well, you may do. It can happen.
Do you have any advice about, you're talking about needing to tackle self-clinging and dying spiritually, and also the dangers of pushing yourself perhaps too far, too quickly, how would you go about that, and that balance?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, in the end, this is where friendship comes in, isn't it? Because you need to talk with others who can give you some sort of feedback and perspective. They may not have it all sorted out, but you can at least dialogue with them and gradually sense what's going on. And when you do try something, and it has a particular effect which is not very pleasant or problematic, well, you can share that with somebody who can help you to understand it. It's not always going to be comfortable. It's not necessarily a bad thing if it's... the balance right. Well, I think that's where friendship is the key. Mm-hmm. Because that's where you can put things in proportion. And a bit of a broad range of friends. Because some will try to calm you down and say, no, don't worry. But others will say, no, more. And you kind of need to... Find friends who really understand you and understand the Dhamma. But I don't think it's not an easy thing. You can't give a formula, because, as you say, that sometimes what seems like a breakdown can be a breakthrough. And I wrote about that in my recent paper, my own experience of breakdown, which actually I realised was breakthrough.
Yeah.
But sometimes breakdown can just be breakdown. And you just don't have the tools to deal with it. And it might be that it's sort of feeding something that's not quite worked out in you. But I think the biggest danger, my experience in the West, is of a over-intellectualized approach to insight. And a premature engagement with the whole insight world before you've got sufficient integration and sufficient positivity, so that you can do dazzling presentations on insight and so on and so forth, but really not enough of you actually behind it. And this used to be really common in Buddhist circles. I think it still goes on amongst us. So yes, we need to engage with it, but we need to engage with it whilst having a broad approach. All five aspects need to be alive. And Kalyanamitrata is one of the key ways we make sure that breadth is maintained.